Oh, my commercial announcement. 2 for $50. I mean, $15, 2 for $30. And much of what I'm talking about today and talked about for the last hour is actually in here. In fact, one of the first chapters is what is poverty? and by the time you finish, you find out that, since there's no one answer, maybe we shouldn't have a one-size-fits-all government bureaucracy trying to solve the question. And then I also have my story in there. So it's a good read. It's an easy read. And I hope that you will get one for yourself and maybe for one of your good friends. Okay, so when you went out on break, you were thinking about how did we get to the point that half of the country don't believe in our founding principles. You know, it's fascinating because now they're all, they will run as a social. They'll run on their issues now. They're that comfortable that half of the country is not where it needs to be because they've been indoctrinating them in these cesspools that we call schools that are government funded and union controlled, that we can have a national discussion about Medicare for all. We already have Medicare for all. You just have to wait till you're 65 to get it. And even once you get it, you have to supplement it. And some people supplement with Medicaid, which is one of our anti-poverty programs. So I'm looking for somebody to stand up and say, you know what, even Medicare has problems and needs to be reformed. So why would we want to expand it all the way down to 2 years old? And yes, I deliberately said 2 years old because they have, in their philosophy of infanticide, been making the argument that parents should have up to 2 years old to decide if they should keep that child. How do we get to the point that half the people in our country do not believe in eternal truths? Choice loses its meaning if it doesn't matter what we choose. Why we believe what we believe. They do not believe in limited government. The role of government is to protect our interest, not to plunder our interest. They do not believe in free markets. Profit is good. It's the engine for tomorrow. It's moral. Theft is what's wrong. They do not believe in e pluribus unum. Many become one. American exceptionalism. They challenge anytime anyone would even use that word. America is exceptional. It's exceptional because it's the exception to the rule. Prior to America, if you were born poor, you died poor. Prior to America, you're in a caste system based on your family and other interests. After the founding of America, anybody from any ethnicity, any background, any economic situation, any religion, anything, even those that break their lives and need to be born again, have an opportunity to build a peaceful life here. But the other half of the country is bought in this idea of multiculturalism and diversity. Well, what happened? Welcome to the 60s. The left declared three wars on our culture and our society got lost. And voters with government interests vote their government interest. And believe me, a whole lot of Americans now have government interest. In fact, we've gotten to a place where many believe government is bigger and better than God to fix everything. Like R.C. Sproul argued in one of his books, statism is a philosophy of government that believes that the state is not only the final authority, but the ultimate agent of redemption. It's one of the reasons that there is no coexistence. The church has to be supplanted, and that's the root of Marxism. Well, in 1960, 20% of Americans got more from government than they put in. Today, 60% of Americans get more from government than they put in. Why? Well, we had a war on religion. We scrubbed our schools from all reference to God, and it weakened our public institutions and opened the door to a culture of meaninglessness. You get to make it up as you go along. When you buy into the ideas of situational ethics, nothing matters. That's why you can't even trust your governmental bodies, like the IRS or the FBI or the AG. Nothing. Any of the alphabet soup, they're all suspect now. And they're the ones making our laws. But notice that they exempt themselves out of the laws that they make for the rest of us before they pass it. We had a war on marriage during those same body of 60s through a feminist movement. It weakened women and opened the door to a culture of materialism. After two generations of the sexual revolution, marriage has totally collapsed. When it's all about things, marriage is what's on the wayside. Marriage rates have dropped from 75% of the adult population in the 70s to 45% today. That's right. Marriage has totally collapsed. The institution where we hold our values, the institution where we pass our values, and it's a technical term, we even call it institution. Marriage is a sacrament that has now been redefined and has collapsed. Adult marriage rates from the 70s have dropped in half to 30% today. We wonder why the pathologies that we see. Conjugal marriage is the capstone of all humanity, and as a result of its unraveling, our public square is in absolute chaos, and it's opened the door for bigger government. Now government has to solve everything. Sexual and gender matters are now dividing us and bringing into question the very premise of personal responsibility and the role of the church. Frankly, all sexual behavior is adult behavior and should be private. But now it's in the public square, and they dare to have us not even discuss. And as I've told many of them in the LGBTQ lobby community, you're the ones that declared war on pastors and parents. This is private activity. And you're the one that's going to put up with the pushback from pastors and parents. And that's some of the war that we're seeing today when it comes to these sexual and gender matters. Abortion has deeply hurt us, questioning the very premise of humanity and our 14th Amendment protections. 70 million dead in 46 years should give us all great pause. And especially when now we're looking at, it's about enough what we have with Gaza now, where he's collecting baby body parts and putting them on shelves for the young women that are coming in there confused in their lives that think that they're going to have an abortion, and they're looking at baby body parts sitting on shelves as souvenirs. Then we get to see the video of Planned Parenthood in denial and deceiving our society that this is just fetal matter that we're disposing, and we find out that they're selling the body parts, livers, brains. Sick society that we're in today. And who's on trial in California right now? The two young men and the young woman who took the video. Yeah. Right as we speak, they're on trial for their lives because they could do a lot of time if they lose, thanks to Kamala Harris, the next to drop out of the presidential Democrat thing. That O'Rourke left today. Down 999 ago. Not enough we have those instances, but now we have 2,411 body parts scattered everywhere in Illinois and Indiana. Because the abortionist there was such a serial killer that he just left them in the yard, left them at his home. And the reason that number has increased, for those of you that say, I thought it was 2,300 bodies. Dead babies. No, they found him in his car, too. The attorney general there, who is also fighting for his political career, is an African-American, incredible Christian conservative, is in a challenge for his career because some of his co-workers have declared that they at me to him because he went and put his arm around one of them, and she said, oh, no, man, young guys, you know what? We've gotten to the point where they're the purest. You know, at least in the church we can hug. And they want to replace our religion with their religion, where you better not even run. And your career could be at stake. You know, we are so lost now as a society when it comes to abortion. And even on that trend, you know, we're finding out now, oh, the LGBTQ, we knew, they said the Q meant queer. We were just making fun of ourselves. And we find out after marriage that, no, it meant questioning. And so now they've changed all the curriculum in all of our schools. They said that the T meant trans and that we really don't like them. Then why is it in your letter alphabet? And now we're finding it means troubles as well. It's like Ryan Anderson has been trying to expose for a long time. No, they are pushing into law that they don't want wedlock. They want wed lease. They don't want monogamy. They want monogamish. And they don't want couples, they want thruples, as we just saw in the headlines last week, as one of the sitting legislators had to say, oops, I guess I'm a little bit ahead of the curve, breaking the Nesbitt rule. You know, John Nesbitt, the big business guru, he has this saying, don't get too far ahead of the parade, no one will know you're in it. The business, it works. But in this culture war, while we've been sleeping, it's been working as well. And the parade is catching up. In fact, there's one lawyer, you mentioned the Heritage Foundation, a lawyer that's part of them and also part of the Alliance Defending Freedom. She's an international attorney who has come back from her work internationally on behalf of the Coptic Christians. And she's spent a lot of time in China on behalf of the Christians that are under severe persecution and trying to make their legal cases so that they're not slaughtered by these horrible regimes around the world. And so people ask her, she said, her name is Elaine, and she said, Cal. And she said, they said, why did you come back to America? We're not Christian persecution. She said, honey, there are four stages to get to the point of death where they're killing you. And America, in 2 years, has moved to the third stage. Because the first stage is social isolation. You even mentioned that you don't agree with these life patterns, whether it's the sexual and gender matters and or the abortion matters, and you start losing your friends. The second one is economic isolation. I heard that Calvin Cochran spoke for you, to where you find out that it can cost you your job. As Mozilla found out. I mean, he founded that company, and yet he wasn't able to work in his own company anymore because he gave $100 to Proposition 8 in California to protect marriage as between, or define marriage as between one man and one woman. So economic. Then the third stage is political, and that's what's at the courts right now. It's the Supreme Court. People wonder why we had that big dispute over Kavanaugh. Because the heart and soul of this country is at stake. And this president on that front has put 160 conservative judges on the court. And this is incredibly meaningful. This is an extension of God's mercy. So we have this war on religion. We have this war on marriage. And then we had a war on poverty during that same body of time. That had a philosophy built into it to not worry about the natural consequences that may come from your living free, because now we have safety nets. And a whole lot of people got caught up in the safety nets. And the war on poverty weakened family and opened the door to a culture of melancholy. And as I already mentioned, that this concept, the very concept of redistribution of wealth, violates scripture. The Bible says don't covet. And socialism is rooted in covetousness. It says don't steal. You know, the IRS is not sending you a letter saying, how would you like to benevolently give to this anti-poverty program so that Star Parker can ruin her life? No, if you don't pay your taxes, you're going to jail. You don't have a choice in it. It's a violation of property rights. You know, my granddaddy was one generation out of slavery. I didn't know him, never met him. It was one generation out of slavery, and I understand he had to eat it. They're from South Carolina. He said, you want to stay free? You need two things, property and a gun. And we keep a lot of the property. And we look at all the gun laws, all the gun control laws. Where did they start? They first started in our country when the first slaves started coming, because all the blacks that were in this country from a variety of different countries around the world that were in this country were free also. I mean, they were on that Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria. We were all throughout the world at that time. But when our society wanted to bring slaves, the first thing they had to do was remove all the guns from the free blacks. Second time we saw it was after Jim Crow. Because after Jim Crow, it was like, or during, right before Jim Crow, you had a black army now. They had constitutional rights to also bear arms to protect their interests. So laws were passed, the same laws we're hearing about now, background checks. to make sure that they didn't have an arm. And what happened as a result, over 3,000 lynchings where armed men were going into other people's homes, pulling out the male in that house and hanging him on a tree, and he had no protection right. In fact, that's why the NRA founded. Because they felt that this people, these American people, should have the same Second Amendment and constitutional rights as everybody else. And that we didn't have a need for all of these specific little bitty tweaks at this to marginalize certain people. Especially what they're saying now about this, you know, on the gun. And I know this is real off my subject, but on confiscating our Second Amendment right. They want to do all these background checks. I think that there should be a revolt, especially from women who've had abortions. Because they start background checking on and looking for mental health. First of all, that means they need a national database with all of our health records in it to find out who has a problem. And the reason I bring in women who's had abortion is because many women who had abortion have then regret, and so they go to their doctor and to talk to him about the depression that they're feeling. And it goes into their record. This is some serious business when you start thinking about what these people are doing. But anyway, that's a different subject, different speech. I don't have it in here and I don't have the time. But this whole concept of wealthy redistribution doesn't work for poor people. Because under the guise of social justice, it violates the very social structures for one to excel. Because without a moral code of ethics and a rule of law, our poor communities diminish into what one social scientist called the tragedy of the commons. No one owns it, so no one takes care of it. And that's what's happened. In fact, there was a song before, years ago, I think it was Stevie Wonder or somebody did a song, like, our clothes are old, but never are they dirty. Well, you can't say that about the poor today. In fact, you can always tell the difference between an impoverished person who's economically distressed and one that's government dependency. Because the tragedy of the commons, you don't own it, you don't take care of it. In fact, Senator Phil Graham during welfare reform used to come in and say all the time, I've never seen a man wash a rented car. It was like, yeah, they don't, do they? No, you wash your own car. And today, far too many Americans are lost in this mindset. For decades, the socialist policies of hardcore secular Democrats have been dominating our nation's poor communities. You want to see their track record? Looking at any and every distressed zip code across this country, and you can see what they're doing. Zip codes, incidentally, that this president is laser beam focused on fixing. That's how we know that there are 8,700 of them. Oh, he has forced into law through an executive order. I want to see this. I want it fixed. And he forced all of the departments where Bush sprinkled his little faith-based money, thank God, what Trump did with the faith-based offices is he turned them into religious liberty offices, and he also moved into the civil rights offices, religious liberty personnel and attorneys. So we're not doing any of that maddening stuff again, paying the churches, putting them on welfare, take the women off and put the churches on welfare. We're not doing any of that anymore. But at least it identified the 13 departments where we have anti-poverty money. So now he's like, I want to see your budgets. I want to see what you're doing with it. I want everything streamlined when it comes to how we're dealing with and helping these poor folks. Because he understands that the bankrupt ideas of secularism and socialism in America's minority community are glaring. That's why he was able to point to Baltimore and say, it's rat and roach infested. A few people got a little upset. Some of us were cheering, including the people that live in those rat and roach infested communities. After he called some countries shithole countries, somebody did a video from one of them and said, and it went viral in the black community. So it is a shithole country. Why do you think we live over in America, man? There is no freedom without family, and there's no family without faith. Should every American be free to choose? Of course. But recognize that in 2018, growth in America's population was the lowest in 80 years. The census projects that in just 16 years, there will be more Americans over 65 than under 18. Did y'all hear that? In just 16 years, there will be more Americans over 65 than under 18. Pyramid turned upside down. We not only took 70 million out through abortion. The feminists convinced women that children are environmental hazards. Don't have too many. Phew. But in addition to this stalling growth, The effect of the left's agenda on biological and generational family is also alarming. The nuclear family, for instance. In 1968, 58% of all family households in the U.S. had their children under 18 in the household. 58% American households, the husband, married to the mother, children. Today, that number is 38%. Single household. In 1968, 13% of American children younger than 18 lived with an unmarried parent. Okay, 13%. This is 1968. Some of you all were around, because I can see you don't dye your hair like I do. So you remember 68. 13% of American children younger than 18 lived with an unmarried parent. If I had polled the room, I'd say, did you know anyone? Most people didn't know anyone. Or maybe one that everybody pitied and tried to help. Today, that number is 32%. 32% of American children younger than 18 live with an unmarried parent. And without children raising eternal truths, with biological parents and grandparents, our future's in danger. This is the generational challenge is problematic. You know, I was thinking about the other day because my grandson is in high school now, and so he has a project, a generational chart he has to make, and our life is a little bit more complicated because of my heritage originally from the South. But when he asked for the names of my grandparents, I didn't know. I wrote a text my sister. But the beautiful thing for him is he knows his grand. My daughter said, I broke that. Uh-uh. And she married young. She said, no, no, Mom, I'm not like you. And she married young, still married now 16 years and has two children. You got to break these cycles because it's hurting us. When you don't have generations taking care of each other, it's a crisis waiting to happen. And what we have now are youth that don't even want to birth children. Or children growing up with one parent that one day is going to age alone. Now, why does it matter? We want to know, why should we even care? Why should faith and family be part of our national political discussions and debate? A whole lot of Christians say, I'm going to heaven, I don't care. Or a whole lot of wealthy libertarians say, you only need two things for it not to even bother you, time and money, and I got both. Well, one reason we should care, especially as Christian people, is child poverty. 24 million U.S. children younger than 18 live with an unmarried parent. Two-thirds of all poor children in America live in a single-headed household, compared to 8% children in a married household. You see it everywhere. In fact, I was talking to someone on break. I forgot who was it. Was talking about how during the 50s and 60s, what the family life looked like. You know, and it was true. And even today. When you think about black and white, everybody wants to talk about these wealth gaps. Yeah, we see wealth gaps a whole lot and income gaps a whole lot between black and white in general. But when you're specific and bring family life into it and marital life into it, all of a sudden the data changes. And in fact, it changes to the degree that if you have a black husband in the home with his wife raising their children and a white husband in the home with his wife raising his children, we can't even measure the difference. There's not enough there to measure economically, educationally, crime. So for people that keep telling us that, no, this is all about race, it couldn't be because data doesn't lie. Now, you can ask some incredible questions if you're doing polling, but when you're looking at actual number, 8% of children live in marital households are impoverished. And usually it's for a limited time. Because once one gets to working again, I mean, you'll see it in your data. I looked at all of your data. And it broke down exactly like it does everywhere else. And it didn't matter what color the people were, even though it breaks them down color too. Yours is solvable. You don't have a lot of numbers. Yours even broke it down for numerically, not just percentage. But it's the same problem. No worky, no churchy, You go to church, you're going to, church is about personal responsibility, forces you into that concept. And if you don't work, you just don't have any money. There are 400,000 orphans in our foster care system. 3 million children live in our government-owned housing. And this impacts the poor, it just in other ways that we then, as a society, have to try to fix it. Because they struggle in school. They have tremendous difficulty becoming proficient in math and reading. Now, the new numbers are out, but I'm going to use the 2015 numbers. Just last week, the new numbers came out, and I've been traveling, so I wasn't able to bring them to you. But in the case of black children, the 2015 NAEP, the National Assessment for Education Progress Report, you know, it's known as our report card, it's just sad. And in fact, I did read enough about the new numbers that came out last week to notice even sadder today. The gap has gotten bigger. You saw that? There's something going really wrong in our society that our kids are getting worse information and they're going downhill when it comes to their educational aspirations. For black children, the math scores, 17% of black fourth graders and 11% of black eighth graders perform at proficient levels. In reading, 16% of black fourth graders and 15% of black eighth graders were proficient. Now, I'm focused on the black community, but a lot of this data that just came out last week is looking at the Latino community, who were trending up. And phew. And we're looking at also the white community, because these ideas of secularism and Marxism are equal opportunity destroyers. So when you look at what has happened in family life and the out-of-marriage birth rates, in the 60s, in the black community, 22% out-of-marriage birth rates. Today, 72% out-of-marriage birth rates. So we have all these social pathologies as a result of out-of-marriage. Children raised out of marriage. We know them. We know the crime rates. We know the low educational aspiration. We know more promiscuity rates. We know it. We can find it. We even tried to solve it in the 90s through welfare reform. But in the white community, in those same 60s, you had 3% out of marriage birth rates. Today, they're 30%. 8 points higher than where blacks were when they started this social engineering through their great society on a very vulnerable community of people that collapsed their family. And now we're seeing the collapse in the white community. The majority culture is one thing to have a 13% of your population and try to figure it out and work with it and so you can try to get it back on course. But when the majority community is now off course and we start seeing these same pathologies of high crime rate, low educational aspirations, high out-of-marriage rates, high drug rates, we have problems in our society and a government that actually thinks that they can solve it. It's imperative that God's people are understanding what's at root of our challenges today and start thinking about how to fix them. The second reason Christian leaders should be at the table in all of our political discourse is because of crime. It's one thing to have child poverty that's now getting us to the place where you want to talk about sex trafficking? You name the crisis. Think in your mind about any and every social crisis that you may be concerned about. And this is where you see the breakdown. Once family breaks down, and then the next stopgate for a society, which is our Judeo-Christian heritage. And then the only place that we get to put those values in other people's children's lives is through our education. We have problems. I'll get to the education question. But right now, the crime, bookshelves are sagging with research that demonstrate with crystal clear clarity that unmarried men are promiscuous men. And promiscuous men are producing unproductive men all over the place. Like you start getting in sports, this is like one of the guys, he was a manager, he said, I just had to leave. He couldn't even take it. Just to say, yeah, that one that everybody's idolizing got all kind of people out there. When I said my daughter said that she broke it for my life, because that person that impregnated me to have her had 8 children by 5 women. When she found out what it means, the symbolism that it means when the dad walks you down the aisle for her marriage, she had our bishop do it. Promiscuous men are producing unproductive men, and unproductive men are often dangerous men. 70% of the kids that are in our criminal justice system come from single-headed households. The only reason we have any race factor is because it hit the black community first. 95% of men in our federal pen have no relationship with their dad. You know, Proverbs 17 says that the glory of children is their father. The glory of children is their father. So I looked up glory, dictionary definition, majestic beauty. The majestic beauty of children is their father. A height of achievement, enjoyment, and prosperity. So the Proverbs 17 says, the height of achievement, enjoyment, and prosperity of children is their father. The dictionary said, the splendor and bliss of heaven. So Proverbs 17 says, the splendor and bliss of heaven of children is their father. Perfect happiness. So the dictionary said. The definition of glory in the dictionary said perfect happiness. So Proverbs 17 says, the perfect happiness of children is their father. Now that we're working on the homeless situation, because, man, our president with his little Twitter, he went to L.A. He's like, what is this? Yeah. Once it reaches the headline, us policymakers get to think about it and work on it. You know, policymaking is very different from politics. Politics is exactly what Tip O'Neill said it was. It's like professional mud wrestling. The conflict's for the crowd. They're in business, and they're in the same business. You see them lining up at each other's funerals. They don't only go to each other's funerals. They go to each other's ball games. They raise their kids together. So that's politics. But policymaking is like baseball. It's in the definition of luck. It's where when opportunity and preparation meet. So you're preparing most of the time in policy. We're constantly, we're sitting around thinking about these things, moving them around, testing them out, ideas. And then one day, it hits that front page. And that's your opportunity to do something about it. And so we're doing on homelessness now. So so I'm working there. And that's what I've been doing over the last, since he came to L.A. and said, what is this? Even though there's a whole lot of stuff that had been doing before that. But now, you know, it's kind of like, whoa, we got energy. We can go out in there and really and move some things. So I want to see the data, which hasn't been accumulated very well. So you got to look a whole lot of places on the relationship that these homeless guys have with their dad. Two reasons we have challenges with the weakest link, the little lost sheep, the ones that God so cared about. Collapsed ethics and collapsed marriage. And, you know, the Lord was really clear about what to do with the poor. He told us to preach the gospel to them. That's one main. That should be the real red flag to say, government, that first reason, that first thing we should be doing with the poor is reason you shouldn't be in that business. You have to preach the gospel to the poor. Well, what's the essence of the gospel? That God is not mad at them. He has a purpose and plan for them. And when we look at the scripture, you don't see the same kind of scenarios that we have in our society today with how we deal with poverty. When God saw homelessness and hunger, 4,000 people at one point, 5,000 people, his disciples were like, what are we supposed to do with them? He didn't say go to the Romans and set up a food stamp program. He said bring them to me. Feed them. And they multiplied. His people were involved. And they watched miracles from heaven. And we know it's a miracle. Because another place we see instance on how he sees poverty was when his cousin was in jail. When God's cousin was in jail, John told his disciples, hey, go to him and ask my cousin, are you the one or should we look for another? So Jesus then tells John's disciples, go back to him and tell him these things. Tell him that blind people are seeing. Tell him that lame people are walking. Tell him that deaf people are hearing. Tell him that leopards are being cleansed. Tell him that dead people are getting up out of the grave. And tell him that the gospel is being preached to the poor. Now, these are amazing miracles. I think we'd all agree. Blind people seeing, deaf people hearing, lame people walking, leopard people getting cleansed, dead people getting a second chance on this side of eternity, and the gospel being preached to the poor. This seems either out of place, or this in and of itself is an incredible miracle that should not be left in the hands of the government. The third reason to debate matters of culture and government dependency as a body of Christ is diminished morale versus just child poverty. We're just really weakening the most vulnerable amongst us, the little lost sheep. It was a lesson in the lost sheep, the same with children. You put up the little fence, they can play free. You get lost, you go find them, the other kids get secure. You have no fence, no boundaries. Make it bump as you go. We're lost. People ask me all the time, how'd you get so lost? It's easy when you scrub your schools from all reference to God, when you collapse marriage so there's no place to transfer values, when you have a war on poverty that says do whatever you want to do anytime you want to do it and we'll take care of it. So people get lost if you don't know what to do when you have no instruction book. There are rules to govern all disciplines. We know that in every discipline that there are rules to govern that discipline. Whether the discipline is math or science, whether it's medicine, you certainly don't want to go to a doctor with an ailment and him and say, oh, I made it up, that little degree on my wall. I printed it out at FedEx Kinko. You want to know, do you know the rules? There's a discipline here. Do you know the rules? There are rules of music. You don't want just someone sitting down at a piano and just start banging. The rules of fashion. Art. But when it comes to life, we think people can make it up as they go along. And it's not true, and we know it. So what do people do when they don't know what to do? They look outside and see what everybody else is doing, and that's what we've been doing for the last 50 years. And what do you see when you look outside? You see pop culture. And boy, do they push the envelope. We already know what the B's are going to do because they're already showing it on TV. We saw the L's and the G's, and everybody thought it was funny. Now we're at the T's. And all of us social thinkers in Washington is like, boy, they skipped them B's. And when I just suggested, well, we already know through Scripture what's included in the B, because God doesn't say don't do something that you don't have a tendency that you could. And he told us don't lay with them animals. And I'm telling you, when I said that bee better not mean bestiality or we got some issues. They shut my life down to where now I'm in a security protection program. We look outside and we see pop culture. We send our kids to these government... I guess y'all know that I'm not too keen on the public schools. Where they're learning moral relativism. We go into workplace and it's secular humanism. Of course we're lost. And so we have escalated child poverty, we have escalated crime, and now we have diminished morale. The great society of secularism and statism has had great costs, emotional costs, economic costs, and it's taken a toll on all of us as neighbors. We can't even talk to each other anymore. We were actually building race relations. We were having a good time as people. We can't even talk to me anymore. I fly a lot. I travel. I probably do 300,000 miles a year now. And I like Delta, and so I did. I got to my million miles of Delta, and they gave me choices of a gift, free gift, suitcases. I'm like, I kind of have a lot of those already, and you can't come with something else. It used to be just incredible things you would learn and discover by flying, when be trapped up with a bunk mate there for a few hours and just talk about your whole lives again. Now no one says anything. Sit there and watch that little TV and nothing. Diminished morale. Every time I get bumped up to first class, so I turn my TV to Fox News because I know everybody sitting around me wants to watch it, but they're like, an African-American sitting there. I ain't turning that on. And the minute I turn it on, all the TVs turn on to Fox News. It's taking a toll on us as neighbors. Federal government takes 25% of American economy now and has forced the public square to be a constant battleground. No, that's yours, this is mine. Property rights. We saw it again with Ahab, Nabal. He had that one little bitty piece of property, but Ahab wanted that too. God let Ahab get away with a whole lot of mess, but when he stole Nabal's property, oh no, he was not having it, and he had his wife eaten by dogs because it was her idea. Constant battle. Why are we fighting? Because the government's hand is too big in all of our lives. Economic costs are really huge. Poverty's big business, $24 trillion since that war on poverty began. As I mentioned, $900 billion a year. It is a quarter of our budget. They take in $3 trillion and they spend a trillion. They take in $3 trillion. They spend $4 trillion. And a trillion of it is in the anti-poverty programs. Nothing's changed. As I already said, only 20 cents on a dollar actually reaches the households we say we want to help anyway. It's all the bureaucracy. Nothing changed kind of bureaucracy. And you guys are seeing the bureaucracy. In fact, we'll be hearing a whole lot about it next week because they got impeachment now. People that like the status quo. The swamp. Government dependency has seeped into our entire society, and we are in tremendous debt as a result. Overspending $1 trillion a year. Who does that in your budget? You can barely spend over $100 over a month in a month. Who does this? We've reached a dangerous mass of special interests where they have too much stake in big government, whether they're employed by it, collecting benefits for them, businesses getting favors from it. It's crazy. I tell people all the time, when we're debating food stamps, it's in the agricultural bill. And so whenever we're doing ag, we're doing food stamps, and it's the major part of the ag bill. It's like 80% is food stamps. But it's not the welfare mom showing up in Washington when we're having that discussion every time it's up for reauthorization. It's J.P. Morgan, because they manage it. They help with the EBT swipe card and take the little percentages off of it. Last go around, it was Amazon, because they want them to be able to get a discount on their Prime, because they sell food. Walmart showed up one year because they didn't feel that they should have been in the hot seat because some girl tried to buy an iPad with her little food stamps, and their machines don't read that. So the government should buy them new machinery so that they can read which is food and which is not, for eligibility's sake. Oh, one year it was McDonald's, because they didn't feel it right that everybody else gets to take the EBT swipe card. How come we can't take the EBT swipe card? Well, you see it now, and what you're going to start noticing when you go to grocery stores, it's going to say, credit, debit, EBT. Businesses getting favors. They line up. Well, I can tell you all the time, I know exactly what's on the table just by going to the Cap Club. You sit down there and you meet lobbyists from all over the place. And people that hate lobbyists, your business hasn't been attacked yet, because as soon as it is, lobbyists to me are like lawyers and doctors. You don't like them until you need them. And now everybody, even what's his name, the Facebook guy got some lobbyists now. He's like, oh my gosh, I'm a Nazi. Uber got lobbyists. All these little liberals now, they got lobbyists. Because they know that government's after them, too. The economic costs doing business in the poverty business is big business. And the thing about it is, it's a lie that Americans wouldn't do the work anyway. Christian people are very benevolent. We should get out of that. Over and above the $900 billion that they confiscate out of our paychecks to pay for this anti-poverty business, Americans give away another $400 billion in this country through their charitable gifts, and that does not include the tithe to churches. It doesn't include church gifts. And another $300 billion abroad. Now, is it a small percentage of those doing the heavy lifting? Yeah, it is. Should more people pay their tithe and offering? Absolutely. But don't get talked into that we're stingy, and if the government doesn't do it, you're going to have children starving and women dying on the street. It's not true. And in fact, the opposite is true. The minute there's a crisis, the benevolence of America shows up immediately. And when government shows up, they go home.
You told me I had to be out of here at 9 o'clock. And you told me that I have to talk two more times tomorrow.
So I'm going to, oh, okay. 1 minute. No, because I could save the good news for tomorrow. The economic costs, okay, just went over the economic, the emotional costs, we're not free people. We're not free people when judges get to redefine truth. We're just not free. Now, we can pretend and keep pretending and keep pretending and then allow these folks who are telling us exactly what they will do now. Fool us once, shame on you. We bought that through Obama, who really did tell us he was going to transform the country. But most people thought it was positive. But fool us twice, to where you have cover stories of men who think they're married to other men, who in their district has 2,411 fetuses that were buried by an abortionist that everybody was trying to get to shut down, and he didn't do it as a mayor of that little area. We're in a culture war for the heart and soul of this country. And we are not free right now. We are in the third stage before death. We're not free when politicians can pass laws that bureaucrats segment us into special interest groups based on our race or our gender, our income, our assets, our sexual identification. Just to further a social experiment that throughout history has reduced mankind to savagery. What we should have learned from both slavery and Jim Crow is force is not an American ideal. And that's what we're seeing from the aggressive left. Force. Our great challenge today is broken families, enslavement, the government, and out of control debt is not a formula for a great country. But there is good news. And tomorrow morning, what time I have to come in here tomorrow morning?
6:30
in the morning? I'm going to, tomorrow we're going to come back. I'm going to sign books today. So if you guys get books today, I'm going to sign books. But the good news is we can change. The good news is that 100 million Americans still get up on Sunday morning and go to church.
Yes.
100 million still get up and go to church. The few and the faithful, because a whole lot used to go to church. So while pastors are complaining that churches are diminishing in size, I'm like, oh, because God is building his Gideon army. The fact that you still get them go to church on Sunday morning, this is good news that we can really turn things around.
She's
going to
start preaching.
No. I'm going to stop there. But I do want to make one more point about the church, because there is one other thing that's been lied about the church. And I need to correct it while it's on my mind. Because you said that this is about conservatism, it's not racism. And people want to use the church to make the case that they are really bad people because, as in their words, Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. And it's not true. It's a lie. Sunday morning is the most integrated hour in the world. We just get opportunity to worship the way we want expression. This is not true. Some people do it for an hour, bow, go. Some people do it all day. The scripture doesn't say that you have to mix or not. It is clear that with angels and archangels and all the company of heaven, we worship the Lord, and he allows us to decide the worship style in spirit and in truth. The question is not, what color the people you go to worship with? The question is truth coming across the pulpit? And we should not buy that lie that Sunday morning is segregated and come up with all these programs to try to figure out how to eat chicken dinners together. We have to understand that we are the body of Christ and it's worldwide. And if you go into a Korean church, they're speaking Korean. And you're not going to find many other ethnicities in there. You go into and name the church that has an expression in their language. Because God understands that we are uniquely made. We speak a variety of languages. We come from all kind of backgrounds. And he expects and wants and desires our worship. But he gives us a choice on how we want to express our love for him. Thank you.